Good morning. Good morning. It's good to be back. Thank you for inviting me back. Last time I talked, a year ago, I talked to you about the devil, and you invited me back. So that was okay. That went well, I guess. I want to start by sharing something I shared with some ACU students about a month ago. Prospective students were coming to ACU, and I started off by telling a story about a student named Brad. I had a conversation with him a couple years ago, and I want to share that with you to get into our material today. Anyway, Brad was a really smart student, and he had been reading some books written by what are called the New Atheists, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and he was a smart student, and he really was persuaded by some of their arguments. And so he just was having a lot of questions, a lot of doubts, and so he wanted to have coffee. And so we sat down and have coffee to kind of work through some of this. And, you know, it was the normal things you talk about in those conversations. We talk about how you reconcile, you know, dinosaurs with Genesis 1 and problem of pain and suffering, those big kind of questions. So we're deep in this conversation 2-3 hours in, which I loved. I love these conversations with AC students. But I had, as we were wrapping up the conversation, I had been doing a lot of answering or trying to answer. There's no final answers to any of these questions. But I wanted to end by turning the tables a bit and kind of ask him a question. So I said, Brad, we got to go here in a little bit. I said, before we leave, you've asked lots of questions. Can I ask you a question? He said, sure. I said, so here's my question, Brad. Do you want to live a beautiful life? Kind of took him back for a second. I don't think he was expecting that question. He goes, what do you mean? I go, hey, well, do you want to live a beautiful life? And he thought about it. He said, yeah, I do. And I said, so do I. I think many of us want to live a beautiful life. I said, so my question is, what's your aesthetic? Like, what's your criteria for beauty? Because if you want to live a beautiful life, you're going to have to at least say, this is beautiful. Like, this is what I find praiseworthy. This is what I stand back and applaud. This is what moves me. So I said to him, I said, what is it that kind of, when you see something in the world, when you see somebody do something on social media, in your own life, on the news, and it just causes your heart to ache and tears well up in your eyes, you know, what is beautiful to you? And I said to him, because one of the reasons, I mean, we've been talking a lot about this intellectual stuff, but one of the biggest reasons why I am a follower of Jesus, why I'm a Christian, is because whenever I find my heart broken because of something I've seen so beautiful, I've noticed when I've witnessed those things always remind me of Jesus. So for me, Jesus is my aesthetic. As weird as this might sound, I'm into Jesus for artistic reasons. He is the aesthetic that weaves through my world as kind of like, that's the way I want to be. So the last chapter of Stranger God, I share some examples of this. In 2016, a man boarded a subway in Vancouver, Canada. He became aggressive, shouting and cursing at all the other passengers. He jerked around erratically. The man was either mentally ill or on the influence of drugs, and so everybody on the train backs away. And then suddenly, a 70-year-old woman seated nearby reaches out and held the hand of the shouting, cursing man. And that gesture calmed him. The man quieted, then he slumped to the ground with tears filling his eyes. The woman kept holding his hand. And when he reached his stop, the man stood up and said, thank you, and then he exited and he walked away. Ehab Taha was on the train. He took a picture of the old woman and the crazed man holding hands, and he posted the picture to social media, and it quickly goes viral. Quote, it was quite incredible how much he calmed down in a split second, Taha later said. It was the most touching thing that I have ever seen. Later on in 2016, players from Florida State University football team went to visit Tallahassee's Munford Middle School. to spend time with the area children there. And during the visit, the players ate lunch with the kids in the cafeteria. Travis Rudolph, a wide receiver for the Seminoles, spotted a child off by himself, eating all alone in the crowded cafeteria. So Travis approached the boy and asked if he could eat lunch with him. "Sure, why not?" the boy said. And so Travis sat down to have lunch with Bo Paskey. Now Bo is sitting alone, as he did most days, because he has autism. Witnessing Travis and Bo eating together, a friend of Bo's mother snapped a picture of the pair, and Bo's mom then posted the picture to Facebook. The story and the picture again go viral. Sharing the picture on Facebook, Bo's mom wrote, "I am not sure what exactly made this incredibly kind man share a lunch table with my son, but I'm happy to say that it will not soon be forgotten, because this is one day I didn't have to worry if my sweet boy ate lunch alone." Like, when you hear stories like that on Facebook, don't they just break your heart? You're like, that's a beautiful thing. And why is it a beautiful thing? Kindness is what attracts us so much to Jesus. It's Jesus' kindness for those who have been treated meanly or cruelly or dismissively. Our hearts thrill to these stories of kindness on social media because they remind us of Jesus. We see that 70-year-old woman take the hand of the screaming, crazy man, and we think of Jesus' kindness to those who are possessed by devils. And we see that football player eating lunch with an autistic boy, and we think of Jesus touching lepers. We read these stories of kindness on social media, and our hearts leap in a flash of recognition. That is exactly the sort of thing that Jesus would have done. So, do you want to live a beautiful life? What's your aesthetic? What causes your heart to ache? I was with Brian Zahn, a speaker and a pastor, and he had written a book called How Beauty Will Save the World, and Brian was making this exact point. He said, here's the thing. Lots of people don't like Christianity, organized Christianity. They won't set foot in a church, but most people, even atheists, find Jesus beautiful. Like, Jesus is our leading message to a world. And that beauty of Jesus, he argues, will save the world. And that's a quote from Dostoevsky. He's the Russian novelist. Beauty will save the world. And I agree with Brian on that point. We all want to live a beautiful life. But the point I made to Brian when I was with him last was, but this beauty of Jesus is also a little unsettling. Is it not? Like, we find Jesus, you know, we read these stories about Jesus touching lepers, Jesus breaking bread with tax collectors and sinners and prostitutes, right? And our heart's just like, oh, I love Jesus. Who doesn't? But do you think back then, if we were watching Jesus welcome these people, we would have witnessed him with lepers and prostitutes and sinners, and we were like, oh, so gorgeous? Probably not. There's something a little offensive and difficult about this kind of kindness. It's not our default response. There's something a little transgressive about it. Transgressive is just a word from the art literature, which means it goes against our sensibilities, our wiring. It doesn't strike us immediately as beautiful. For example, Jesus keeps showing up in disguise in the Gospels. And it's a little unsettling how the people of God kind of miss him. So think of Matthew 25, the parable, the sheep and the goats, right? So the goats are going, they've just heard, they're going to hell. Depart from me. And they're a little like, why? They want an explanation. And so here's the explanation. The reason why you are damned is I was incarcerated and you never showed up. I was sick in the hospital and you never visited me. I was hungry, you never fed me. Thirsty, you never gave me anything to drink. And I was homeless, and you never gave me a bed. That's why. Because, and they're still like, but seriously, honestly, Jesus, we never saw you in any of those situations. We never saw you in jail. We never saw you homeless. When did we ever? And he says, whenever you did not do it for one of these least of my brothers, that was actually me. And so this kindness that breaks our heart is difficult. We miss it. It's right in front of us, and we aren't welcoming and hospitable to the person right in front of us. Another example of Jesus coming in disguise, God coming to us in strangers. The disciples are gathered around, arguing as they do about who's in charge of the kingdom. And Jesus takes a child, puts the child in the center of the disciples, and says, whenever you welcome one of these little ones, who do you welcome? That's me again, in disguise. And I think for Americans, we struggle to understand how transgressive that example was, because Americans tend to be, particularly American Christians, tend to be very child-centric, right? We love children. Children are kind of the focus. That was not the case in Jesus' time or place, right? Kids were not at the center of their affections. Who was? Who's at the center of that culture? Who would it have been? Men, right? Men are at the center. Who are around the men? The women, and then who? It's actually not the children. It's the animals. Back then, an animal was more valuable than a child, because the child was dependent and needy, and an animal was actually worth something. And so it's actually worse. Men, women, animals, cattle, then your kids. So now think about what Jesus is doing with his example. He grabs this forgotten person on the far edges of their affections, far edges of their concerns. He grabs that person, and with kind of a shock, puts them in the middle and go, that person, the one that you're not even paying attention to? I mean, this person isn't even in your peripheral vision. This person is in your blind spot. Like, you can't even see them. They're so far off your radar screen. That person is me. And how you treat them is how you treat God Almighty. Well, that's a startling way to wake up and think about the day, is it not? What if that was your guiding agenda today? You woke up in bed and go, who is in my moral blind spot? In this room? In the hallways of your school? In your workplace? In your neighborhood? Like, who is the person so far off my radar screen that I hardly even know they exist? Again, I'm not talking about peripheral vision. I'm talking the blind spot. Because Jesus says, kindness to that one is kindness to me, kindness to Jesus. And so we're kind of stuck here, right? We want to live this beautiful life. Our hearts thrill to these stories of kindness. But not everybody on the subway reaches for the hand of the crazy guy. Not everybody that day looked for the kid sitting alone and went and sat with him. So we want to live a beautiful life, and yet we find that we struggle to pull it off. So why? Why can't we execute the aesthetic that we say we want to live up to? So I'm a psychologist, so here's a little psychology. And let me kind of introduce this by contrasting what's going on, why it's so hard to do kindness, with how we tend to think our moral and spiritual formation occurs. Most people, I'm assuming today, think this is what it's like to be like Jesus. This is what it involves to be more and more Christ-like. It sounds like this. You're going through life, on the journey of life, and then you get to kind of a moral crossroads, like a decision point. And there's this choice to either choose to be like Jesus or not. right? We get to these moral decisions, and everybody in the room, we want to what? We want to choose well. We want to ask the question, what would Jesus do? And then we'll do it. Isn't that how you kind of think about tomorrow, what tomorrow's going to be like? I'm going to try to do the right thing. I'm going to try to make good choices. Here's the bad news as a psychologist. Nobody's making any choices. You're not making choices. All we're doing are having feelings about people. Let me illustrate this way. One of my favorite things to say to audiences is this. The battle to be like Jesus is won or lost in milliseconds. The battle to be like Jesus is won or lost before you even know there was a decision to be made. Psychologists talk about how the brain, there's a book out that's been written by a Nobel Prize winning psychologist called Thinking Fast and Slow. So psychologists tell us that your brain actually has two processing systems. There's a slow part of your brain. It's the rational, deliberative, planning part of your brain, right? The part that kind of lays out, what are you going to do today? What's my plan? And that's the slow part of the brain, thinking slow. But then there's this other part of the brain, thinking fast. And the fast part of your brain is unconscious, automatic, and largely emotional. The point I want to make to you is the reason why we don't end up showing kindness is because that fast part of the brain causes us to just pass right over people. And we end up failing in our acts of kindness. One of my favorite examples of this is from George Sanders' commencement address at Syracuse University some years back. Sanders is a novelist, and he was trying to talk to these graduating college students about what he regretted most in his life. And this is what he said he regrets most about his life. What do I regret? Being poor from time to time? Not really. Working terrible jobs? No. Skinny dipping in a river in the Sumatra and looking up and seeing 300 monkeys pooping into the river in which I was swimming naked and with my mouth open? Not so much. Do I regret the occasional humiliation? Like once playing hockey in front of a big crowd, which had included this girl I really liked, and I somehow managed, while falling and emitting this weird whooping noise, to score on my own team and send my stick flying into the crowd, almost hitting the girl that I liked. No, I don't even really regret that. But here is something I do regret. In the seventh grade, this new kid joined our class. In the interest of confidentiality, her name was Ellen. And Ellen was small and shy, and she wore these big blue cat-eye glasses that at the time only old ladies used to wear. And when nervous, which was pretty much always, she had this habit of taking a strand of hair into her mouth and chewing on it. And so she came to our school, to our neighborhood, and was mostly ignored and occasionally teased. Your hair tastes good, that sort of thing. And I could see that this hurt her. I still remember the way she'd look after that insult. Her eyes cast down, a little gut-checked, as if having just been reminded of her place in things. And she was trying to disappear as much as possible. And after a while, she'd just drift away with that hair strand in her mouth. And at home, I imagined after school, her mother would say, "How was your day, sweetie?" "Oh, fine," she would say. And her mother would ask, "Are you making many friends?" And she'd say, "Sure, lots." And sometimes I would see her hanging around alone in her front yard as if afraid to leave it. And then they moved, and that was it. No tragedy, no big final hazing. One day she was there, and the next day she wasn't. End of the story. Now, why do I regret that? Why, 42 years later, am I still thinking about that? Because relative to most of the other kids, I was actually pretty nice to her. And sometimes I even mildly defended her. But still, it bothers me. So here's something I know to be true, although it's a little corny, and I don't quite know what to do with it. But what I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. The Ellens of the world are in our blind spot. And nobody probably woke up that day at school and said, you know what, I just want to be a cruel, mean person. I'm sure none of you guys showed up today and went, you know what, today's the day. Today's the day where I'm just going to be cliquish and too busy to pay attention, mean, and no. Nobody's making choices. You're not just choosing this. You're just an awkward teenager, and then you notice that years later, you just think about, I could have, what's going on with us? The battle to be like Jesus is won or lost in milliseconds. It's largely because, how I describe it in the book, is we're all on a social autopilot. We're drawn to some people and not towards others. And you don't even notice it's happening. So it's like, here's a classic example. You're standing in line at Walmart, okay? Grocery store, and you're busy, and it's a long line. And you're like, what are all these people doing here? And you're like, it's spring break, you know? So and you're getting in line, you're trying to hurry, and then you see the lady in front of you pull out all her coupons, and you're like, trying to save money. I need to get, you know, like, you guys ever been there? Like, you're just in this, imagine this consumer situation where you're standing there next to the magazines at Walmart, just hating on everybody in the line. Again, you're not making a choice there. We don't sit there and go, standing there next to the magazines, go, hey, wait a second. This is one of those moral forks in the road, right here in Walmart, where I could choose to be generous to the people I'm in line with or not. You don't even notice there was a decision to be made. You're just hating on the line. Or you're at work or at school. For the teenagers and college students, right? You're about to go out, like, hey, should we ask so-and-so? And you're like, no, they're a bit of a freak show. They're awkward. Like, no, don't invite them. Of course not. For those who are in the workplace, right? You're going out to lunch. Hey, everybody go out to lunch. Hey, John's not here. Should we let him know where we are? Like, no. Because John, you know John. It's hard to get along with. I mean, you don't notice at the moment when you're extending an invitation. You don't sit there and go, hey, wait a second. This is one of those forks in the road where I can actually be kind. You don't even notice it. You just are like, no, freak show, and you walk off. And then 42 years later, you have an Ellen story. And you didn't even know at the time that you had a choice. Or here's one of my favorite examples, because I travel a lot. Has anybody been like laid over late at night in an airport, like last flight out, and it gets canceled, and you got to stay the night? You guys ever been so this happened to me recently, because that nor'easter that was happening over there, like I got stuck pretty. And so it's like late at night, it's like 1 a.m., they've canceled this flight multiple times, and finally it's like, ladies and gentlemen, we're not going, we got to stay the night. And so like this 100 people line up. There's like one ticketing agent from America and there to check out and rebook all these people. You've seen this, right? How does the line treat the ticketing agent? Right? And how many, this is Texas, how many Christians are in that line? Like I tell my son, you can't throw a rock in Texas without hitting a Christian. And yet there we are on that line. And we're going to just beat down this ticketing agent. One after another. Because nobody is saying in the middle of the line, in the middle of their hunger and their fatigue and their frustration, which I get, nobody's standing in the line at 1 a.m. in the Dallas-Fort Worth airport going, hey, wait a second, everybody. This is one of those moral forks in the road. You aren't making choices. You're just angry and frustrated or irritated or annoyed or bored. And we're becoming unkind. So what's the call here? The call is to step up the Walmart, in the workplace, in the cafeteria at school, or at 1 a.m. in Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, to step up to the ticketing agent and be kind. My favorite example of this comes from my wife, who's right down here. Hello, sweetie. Jana is a theater teacher, and she preaches kindness to high school students and middle school students because they can be pretty cruel. So kindness is a big value in Jana's classroom. And Jana tells this story where a little kid, kind of like the Ellen kid, picked on, tiny, ran into her room one day, shut the door behind him, took a deep breath, and said, I've been waiting to get to this period all day because nobody can be mean to me here. So when you get up to that ticketing agent, what kindness is saying, with me, nobody will be mean to you here. And have you not seen how that affects people? When you insert kindness into one of those situations, have you ever been able to muster the moral courage to walk up to that ticketing agent when everything is saying is, all I just wanted to do is get home tonight, but you summon the moral courage to notice what's going on, and you step up to the ticketing agent and say, hey, how's your night going? And she laughs and goes, oh. And I go, I know. Have you ever done that, inserted kindness? Do you ever see people's physically relax because you're not going to be just one more person that's going to beat them down? Have you ever seen that sense of relaxation that when you're coming, people relax because of your kindness? Do you guys realize that is exactly what people felt when they saw Jesus coming? And you can do that. 24/7. But you got to pay attention. You got to pay attention. We have to practice. Here's the practical nugget. We have to practice this with the intentionality of a disciplined prayer life. We got to practice this kindness with the intentionality of a disciplined study of Scripture. You have to practice this with the. Some of you guys work out a lot. How many of you guys work out a lot? You guys work out a lot? You got to practice this the same way you practice with the discipline and intentionality of which you pursue your fitness. Or if you're an artist, or you play guitar, with the intentionality and the discipline and the practice of your guitar or your band or your art, whatever it is you're passionate about. If Christians could just become passionate about being like Jesus, you know how to do it. We know how to do it. Kindness is not difficult. It's not rocket science. It's attention. It's attention to the person in front of you. If you have a Bible, let's end in the book of Ruth very quickly. In the book of Ruth, whenever I go around talking about kindness, because Stranger God is really just a book about kindness, and you might have observed that I'm somewhat passionate about that, but a lot of people go like, really, kindness? Particularly all my college students who are social justice warriors. Like, have you not looked at the world? It's falling apart. Politically. You know, it's just, the world is falling. Do you guys ever feel that? You feel like just the world is spinning out of control? It's getting worse and worse and worse. I mean, big problems seem to require big solutions, and you just want me to be nice standing in line at Walmart? Like, that's your solution? Let's turn to the book of Ruth. What I love about Ruth is it's really just a story of kindness. You know the story. Chapter 2. Ruth, the foreigner, the unattached woman, is gleaning in Boaz's fields. And so chapter 2, verse 5, Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, who does that young woman belong to? And that's the attention part. She, if anybody is in his blind spot, it's her, right? That day in the field, an unattached foreign woman is the last person he should be paying attention to. He's got workers to deal with, people to pay. He's a businessman. He's got things going on. And yet he takes the time to go, who's that? And they tell him. And then what he does is incredibly kind. Verse 8, so Boaz said to Ruth, my daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field. Don't go away from here. Stay with the woman who worked for me. And watch the field where the men are harvesting. Follow along after the women. Because I have told my men not to lay hand against you. He protects her from sexual assault. He covers her and says, in my field, no one will be mean to you here. And what I love about this story is verse 1, chapter 1. Verse 1, chapter 1, this whole story, when did it occur? During the time of the judges, the book just prior. And the reason why that's important is, like, has anybody recently read the book of Judges? It's awful. I mean, it's just awful. It ends. The ending, do not read it. It's depressing. It is horrifying. I mean, literally, Israel is falling apart. Kind of the way we feel about America. It is falling apart. Morally, it has gone off the railroad tracks. Politically, there's a civil war breaking out. Like, it is, the world was falling apart. And in the middle of that chaos, like in the middle of America 2018, the Bible zooms in on this act of kindness. Ruth to Naomi and Boaz is to Ruth. And the reason why I love that is, who do Boaz and Ruth become the great-great-grandparents of? David, King David. And who is the eventual great-great-grandson of King David? Jesus. In the middle of this horrible political chaos, in the middle of America 2018, the Bible zooms in on this intimate, kind story of just anonymous little people doing very small, kind things. And through their kindness, God saves the world. This is how God is going to unravel the knots that we tie. So this is my benediction for you. I pray that you aspire to live a beautiful life. And I pray that tomorrow morning, when you're at school or work, or you're staying at home, as the world looks at your life and they watch the way you move through the world, through the cafeterias and the hallways and the bedrooms, the house, as the world stands back and watches you do your thing, that their hearts will ache with how beautiful it is. And they will say about you, you know what? That's exactly the sort of thing that Jesus would have done. Let's pray. Father in heaven, make us kind. Give us the eyes to see the Ellens in our moral blind spots. Help us be people of peace and kindness and safety. May we live a beautiful life in the image of your Son, in whose name we pray. Amen.